When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Charles Barkley, host of the season premiere of Saturday Night Live with Nirvana. Look, Mom, your favorite, Nirvana.
All right, let's do one more. You're a little rushed.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one, too. It's getting funner when we get down to these higher records. And sure. Also, you know, it's always fun to talk to you. But, yeah, I'm super pumped you could do it today. I just threw it out there. I'm like, well, it is New Year's Day. But I'm literally, you're taking me away from spackling walls right now. So,
oh, I'm happy to do that. I mean, geez. Yeah, and frankly, with 2021, it's not going to be that much different for a while than 2020. Yeah. So
I figured it was worth asking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is definitely a much better New Year than I was going to have. So.
Aw, that's very nice of you. You're much too kind. Are you sure you're not Minnesotan? Yeah.
I might as well be. You know, in California. I don't know.
You're a lot nicer than me, man.
But that's the charm of Baco, you know?
Is it?
I think so.
I am talking with Brian Davis, host of the Damn Good Movie Memories podcast. I have nothing but nice things to say about you, Brian, and that's one of them. Did you watch the KISS 2020 pay-per-view yesterday, I assume, since you were off?
There's so many clips out there that you didn't have to pay for it, and I think I posted somewhere, I heard the sound check to Detroit Rock City and I dubbed it Dubai Puke City because that's pretty much what's going on there. No, I did. I wasn't going to pay for that. How about you?
No, there was no chance I was going to pony up for it. We'll get into now. I will tell. Well, it'll be already be out by the time this episode drops, but we're getting into that on the first episode of Cobras and Fire. So we were both able to watch a little bit of it, but neither one of us plunked down any money. And we'll explain it in that. I'll tell you this, for all the lip sync talk with Paul Stanley, he doesn't do it enough. he needs to lip sync the speeches between songs. It's difficult to listen to him. That's really, at this point, my biggest takeaway. That keeps me from, going to shows, watching shit like that, even if I was willing to take the day off and plunk down $50. It's him. Look, I don't fault him, other than that he continues to be arrogant about it and act like it's not an issue.
Exactly.
So,
and I saw I Was Made for Loving You, and that's, I mean, they used the Pat Boone backing track on that one because he didn't even try to go for it. It's like, okay, buddy.
I'm going to look that one up then. I would definitely want to check that. Look, I know he's using some stuff, but yeah, he just doesn't sound good at any point. You know what I mean? It's just
exactly. And you would think that the year off would have helped, but no, it did not.
Well, how are things over there at the goddamn Good Movie Memories podcast?
we're now changing it to goddamn Movie Memories, but it's been great, and I've been able through my vacation to really stockpile movies, which has been a lot of fun. And you've guessed it. I think I counted three. So it was High Fidelity, The Other Guys, and Grandma's Boy. Mm-hmm. And I always love having you on because you always have something interesting and funny to say. And that's what we do there. I mean, that we just get a kind of a wide range of people talking about, movies they enjoy. Usually movies that are in their collection because We could talk about, you know, films that you don't really like, but I don't do that here because I'm not going to spend hours and hours researching a film for something I don't like. So, unlike this album. So this is
spoiler so nice alert.
No. I'm not spoiling anything. So
yeah, and rumor has it I will be on a future episode of Goddamn Good Movie Memories. Right.
That's right, and it's a movie probably most people haven't seen. So, but it's a great movie, and it's actually kind of there's a loose connection, I guess, at least musically, to In Utero and Nirvana. I think in some ways, I think it's kind of the precursor to what eventually became Run.
There's a tease. So yeah, pay attention to that. I'm not sure when you're dropping it, but we are recording that shortly here. So
yeah, and I do want to say, like, look, listening to Whatever Nevermind, that intro medley that you did, it's so well put together because in 30 seconds it basically encapsulates everything that's great about grunge seamlessly, and so it totally gets me in the mood every time I hear it. So really kudos to you. And then the cherry on top, of course, is the Whatever Nevermind part. Yeah. But
let's break a little news here. I was actually gonna lead with that, but that was beautifully set up. I put that medley together. It's just kind of like I wanted a consistent opener, a little different than what we do with Cobras and Fire. And it's something that basically sets off every episode. And then I was really looking for somebody. I knew there had to be quotes from movies where someone just, you know, sarcastically said whatever and then never mind. but I promise you, I spent about an hour and then all of a sudden it dawned on me. You know who would probably be able to pull this out of his ass in about 10 minutes? Brian Davis. And ladies and gentlemen, we have to thank Brian Davis for the Nevermind clips. Those are directly from you, man. Well, I mean, you didn't create them, but I'm like, help me, brother.
Well, I was happy to do it, and it was fun to put together. I'm like, you're right. There has to be something out there, and the way you edited it in was beautiful. So I always get a smile every time I hear that, and then it goes right into the episode.
It's like a little secret for you. Now I've ruined it for you, maybe I've brought fame to your lap.
Well, we'll see when this drops. We'll see if the numbers go up. We shall see.
But thank you for that. You've been a big part of the intro to the show, apparently.
Absolutely.
All right. Well. Before we get into the record today, tell me a little bit about your connection with grunge. Is it big, small? Like, how big of a fan are you? Were you, that kind of deal?
Sure. I'll get into kind of what I grew up with, and then how that kind of evolved into grunge. I would say that at the time when at least Nevermind came out, so if we were just talking about Nirvana in 91, it wasn't necessarily in my wheelhouse of music at the time. I pretty much grew up listening to traditional blues music from the 50s and the 60s, along with, you know, rock and roll in the same era, Jerry Lewis and Chuck Berry and guys like that.
How old would you have been in 91 then?
Then I would have been about 13.
Oh, really? So, by the music you're describing, I was guessing about 70, but all right.
No, exactly. I am exactly the opposite, and that's probably why I love Damn Good Movie Memories so much and doing old films anything historic I love. And my father was so much into the blues and soul music and Stax and Motown that it just kind of came naturally. And so by the early 90s and late 80s, I was progressively getting into more hard rock bands that were influenced by the blues, of course, you know, Aerosmith, AC/DC, Zeppelin, even Sabbath. So I kind of thought about this for a while, like, why did grunge kind of resonate with me? And I think that grunge has a whole lot more in common with the blues than most people even realize. It's not obvious because it's not based in the music itself. I think it's more like the ethos from the founders of blues music, because original blues music was always in the underground, mostly because it was black music. It was segregated. And so even the bigger named artists, like your Muddy Waters, your Howlin' Wolf, your B.B. Kings, they didn't really start to have crossover success until the British invasion of the 60s. So, and then they could tour Europe. It was like a whirlwind for these guys. And sort of kind of like how grunge didn't really start overnight, of course, but you listen to Whatever, Nevermind, you hear that. And though it may have felt like it was overnight for those not engaged in the scene, and then you think of like the Facelift album from Alice in Chains, and it's super heavy blues. I mean, listen to Man in the Box; it's almost like a slower, spaced out, chunkier riff to, let's say, the Doors' Roadhouse Blues, which is that traditional dun 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 dun. Whereas, you know, Man in the Box is just dun, dun, dun. And if they'd stuck with the original, which I think was going to be more sped up, it would have been Roadhouse Blues. And so U.S. in the beginning riff to Sea of Sorrow, it's Total Blues. Same with I Can't Remember. So, you know, Soundgarden covered Howlin' Wolf with Smokestack Lightning. And Nirvana covered, you know, Lead Belly on Where Did You Sleep Last Night for the Unplugged show. So I think all of this sort of clicked in my blues subconscious. And the A-list grunge bands, they became part of my music discovery growing up. But not the B and C list. I didn't have time for them. So I also, what I think is interesting about the blues angle, it's ironically, it's the hair metal acts that tried to go for the rootsy blues vibe in the late 80s. And it came off so forced and not authentic at all. So I think without even realizing it, the grunge bands really had that blues ethos and that stuck with me. So yeah, it's a long answer, but that's where I was coming from. I still love the blues and there's still grunge bands that I still listen to today. And I think the honesty behind their music is what resonates with me still.
You mentioned the hair metal thing, and I was a huge fan. I think it's pretty much well known, and you know, still am to when it just comes to the music and stuff. But I was, you know, buried deep into that. But I've also been somebody who has I have a short fuse when it comes to cliches and certain kind of platitudes. Just imply that just across the board, not just to music. And one thing you always saw in the 80s, especially as the bands got more and more popular, is with every new release, whoever's, you know, in the band talking about it would go, yeah, we went more back to kind of a bluesier approach and all this
right,
shit.
Right, our roots.
And at a certain point, I started going, there is nothing bluesy about what you guys do. This Motley Crue record sounds not any more bluesy than any other Motley Crue record, Nikki Sixx. And it just kind of became cliche, and I think that maybe that was really setting me up to embrace something like grunge when it finally did come, because for a short period, I basically just took a giant dump on all the hair metal bands. I was like, fuck them all. I literally, like, don't like that no more, and then, you know, a little hypocritical, to be honest with you. I've owned it, I think, on this show enough that I don't need to get into it too much more. But you bring up an interesting point there, because, yeah, how many times, and then any time they did do something, they tried to do a blues song, it was always the worst rendition of that.
My daddy said, son, don't you come to me crying. It don't make you happy, man. I don't know. He said the grass is always greener, babe. Every place, still where you stand. Well, some are born to win, some. And sing them poor boy blues. Watch out.
Always, even Kiss. We were talking about Kiss with Rise to It. You know, they start with that kind of that slide acoustic guitar, and before they go, I'm like, really, guys, you're not fooling anyone. And
it's even recorded really bad. It's like, you don't even know it. This sounds tinny and just whatever.
Yeah, and never mind. But it's
never mind. We're not talking about never mind. I'll use that as a segue here. Coming in at number 8 on Rolling Stone's greatest grunge albums of all time is Nirvana's 1983, turns out to be a swan song, In Utero. Now, this was released on my birthday, September 13th, 1993, on DGC Records. In Utero is the third and final studio album by Nirvana. And it was produced by Steve Albini. I think I got his name right. It features 12 tracks, clocks in at a pretty appropriate 41 minutes and 23 seconds, which turns out is slightly longer than it took to record this gem. it was recorded over a two-week period in February of 1993, not very far, Brian, from where I'm recording right now, maybe about a 40-minute drive, at Pachyderm Studios in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. Now, Cannon Falls is also famous for a strip club called Peelers. I do have a question for you, Brian.
Sure.
Have you ever been to Cannon Falls, Minnesota, and not stopped in at Peeler's for a quick, peek?
Well, I've never been to Cannon Falls, but now
so
I
that's
know
a
where
no.
to go.
Every time Ryan has been to Cannon Falls, he has gone to Peeler's.
But I know where to go now, which is good.
I'm not sure if it's open anymore.
Oh, damn it.
Fun fact about Cannon Falls. I got all these Cannon Falls jokes here. My freshman year girlfriend, she actually moved to Cannon Falls and about a week later broke up with me. So fuck you, Lori Stordahl.
But did she end up at Peeler's?
she would have had to get a boob job if she did.
Well, you never know.
Man,
that's what Facebook's fair for, you know.
Hold on a second, I'll check.
Okay.
Lori, there's absolutely no chance you're listening, but I'm just joking.
Yes.
If you even remember me, you probably remember I'm kind of a jerk. So, which is probably why you moved to Cannon Falls and dumped my ass.
Coming up next on Covers and Fire.
Yeah, we'll cut a vein once in a while. In Utero, it did reach number one basically on release in both U.S. and the United Kingdom and plenty of other countries that don't matter. The album has been certified 5 times platinum in the United States and has sold 50 million copies worldwide. It features the singles Heart-Shaped Box and All Apologies. There were plans to release a third single, but Kurt Cobain killing himself kind of put everything basically just scrapped on that whole deal. So not to make light of that. But I think you said you were 13. So you'd have been 16 or 15 or 16 15, when this came out?
15. Yeah. And, you know, like most people, I was introduced to Nirvana through Nevermind. What was interesting is when Nevermind came out, that was 91. My family that year decided to finally get cable. So it was like the perfect storm of me binge watching MTV whenever I could and seeing Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all the great bands. But Nevermind was definitely in my rotation early on. I enjoyed it. I went back and got Bleach and then got Incesticide when it came out. So yeah, I was eagerly anticipating In Utero. I don't think I bought it the day it came out and probably waited like a week. And I didn't buy it on CD because I bought it on cassette and, you know, being.
But
you know, 15,
you were someone that was awaiting it and then bought it.
Yes.
Who cares?
Early
if it's,
on.
Yeah. Basically, once it came out, you knew you were going to get it.
Exactly. Yeah. When I heard the release date, I was like, yeah, this I'm in on this.
Brian, in a move that seems very obvious to me, and I say this even with the time, but, you know, some of the research I did, it made it sound like people were shocked that Nirvana would do a record like In Utero. After Nevermind, I say what you want, but Kurt Cobain was a guy with pretty legitimate conviction. You know what I mean? And he actually cared about his personal integrity. You know, he would not be kissing 2020 goodbye in Dubai.
Right.
So that's probably enough kiss cracks. anyway, so when they go with someone like Albini, who I was not familiar with at the time, but they did more of a raw punk record. They didn't try to get more polished than Nevermind. If anything, they tried to like make sure that like, hey, we're going to stay true to our original ethos. Go back to when you actually did get to hear In Utero. Did you have some kind of revolt against it or how did you feel?
No, I think I enjoyed it at the time. I will get into eventually how I adapted, and that makes sense. I mean, because it's been 25 years. So, I was eagerly anticipating. I liked the first single. The first single sounded similar to what I would have enjoyed on Nevermind or Incesticide. So, it was great. And but I, for whatever reason, and I'll also get into this. I didn't buy it on CD. I don't know why. Maybe because it was just it would have been $20 and having a limited
that
income.
That was kind of that era. I think Aaron Camaro made a great point. Like there was times where you would kind of like have all these different rationale for like, well, is this CD worthy? Is this
you know?
Because I was still buying a little bit of cassettes, but mostly CDs. I don't know. I get it.
Yeah. And so this was, I don't know why, it was a cassette because I had bought Nevermind on CD. I got that through BMG. So that was basically a penny that I never paid for. And but on the other hand, for Pearl Jam's Versus.
You know, I'm older than you. There was a time when you actually had to tape a penny to a little circle where you put the penny.
Oh, I remember that.
Oh, okay. All
right. I definitely remember that. But like for Pearl Jam Versus, that was CD. For Aerosmith's Get a Grip, that was a CD too. So I don't know why. Maybe I had some sort of subconscious foresight about getting this on cassette instead of CD. But, you know, eventually I did get it on CD when I had more disposable income. But, yeah, it's, I don't think there was a revolt. And I'll get into maybe when we wrap up why I always gave this a chance.
Yeah.
Instead of just discarding it immediately, because I think today it's so easy to discard music because of streaming and whatnot. And whereas back when we had to actually buy music, there was less of a chance to, right. or at least an idea of oh, I'm not going to listen to this again. You just paid money for it. So
that's a great point. And yeah, it's not like this record was a flop.
No, not at all.
But Kurt initially wasn't that pleased with the record, but with a little time and apparently some feedback from people he trusted, he grew to like it. Dave Grohl said in 2013 that it was the most honest record he had ever made. And mm-hmm. Chris Novoselic, when he was asked about it, he said, "I play bass." No, in all seriousness, like he would tell NPR, "In Utero is a testament to the artistic version of Kurt Cobain. He had a good ear for a hook, great singer, great guitar player, and In Utero
it's easy for you to say.
Good representation of what he liked in art and how he liked to express himself."
Right. Yes.
Okay. It was originally titled "I Hate Myself and Want to Die." Do you like that title better?
I think if they really wanted to go with some street cred, that would have been maybe a little bit better. I don't think the Suits would have, Geffen would have liked that. Though that song did eventually come out in Beavis and Butthead, which I thought was kind of fitting.
That's a good point. Apparently, verse, chorus, verse, and Sappy were also tossed around before finally settling on In Utero, which we have Courtney Love to thank for that gem. The album yep. cover features what is called, let me read this here, transparent anatomical mannequin, mm-hmm. which is a thing, with wings superimposed over it on a field of lemony amber. Lemony amber. That's that lemony amber, Brian? That's mine.
Yes.
That's my. Yes, I put that in there.
I have seen, I believe in Seattle, there's a museum before everything shut down that I think has the, or something like I could be making this up. I seem to recall seeing that cover with.
You make a lot of things up.
I do. And that's why I have bad damn good movie memories or goddamn
God
movie memories.
Damn good movie memories.
But I do remember seeing it. They had all sorts of, you know, memorabilia from Nirvana at the Seattle Museum. And yeah, I do seem to recall seeing like that album okay. cover there. So
I found some pictures online. Like it's an actual, it was a photograph of this
right.
3D. It's a physical thing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, upon release, Walmart refused to sell it, which actually made me like this record a little bit better. But
agreed.
Hilariously, and this is according to a New York Times report, Walmart said it didn't carry it due to lack of demand.
Oh, that's horseshit.
Sam Walton's like, "Rape Me is my jam. Too bad nobody wants this record."
That's right. That's right. And I bought this at Tower Records because Tower Records here in the Bay Area, at least in California and the West Coast, that was the place to go. And even though you paid more money, they had the best selection. So
before we get into side one of your cassette, Brian, would we be listening to this in your car, or did you have a nice home stereo that we're going to plug this bad boy into?
I think I had a decent home stereo, if I recall. I went through a lot back in the day, and it seemed like every Christmas I was getting a new you know, boombox or stereo.
Only child?
No, definitely not. No, I have a younger sister, so she'd probably get my broken hand-me-down. So
I get you.
Eventually, when I was driving about a year later, I think this was in the rotation. But when I first got it, it was definitely at home.
Well, let's paint the picture for the listener. What kind of car?
Sure.
What was your first car?
It was the family truckster. It was the minivan, the Dodge Caravan. Ooh. From 1985, which was a stick shift and a four-cylinder. So have fun in the hills of San Francisco with that piece of shit. And but my friends loved it because you could pack in 10 people and we could, you know, go to the beach and have parties and things like that. That was the first hand-me-down car. My first real car, I bought a truck, an 85 Dodge truck to go to college, go to junior college. So that was my first real car that I paid for. So
well, that's what we're riding in then. So as we're listening and talking today, we are cruising around with Brian in the driver's seat.
That's right.
Any last words before we pop the cassette in here?
No, let's get it going.
All right. Well, the album opens up with "Serve the Serpent." Serpents. It's like a biblical reference. Serve the Servants.
Yeah, unlike Nevermind or even Bleach, they started out the album with a song that almost sounds like a demo and nothing like the first single that we'll eventually get into. It's incredibly sloppy, though ironically, it's got one of Kurt's more memorable guitar solos that he's ever recorded for me.
Okay.
The chorus sounds like, you know, he almost recorded it for a different song, and nothing about this song fits. Even the solo sounds like it should have been used in a different song, as good as it is. I think it's a real terrible way to start the album. Though, as you mentioned, if they were going for a vibe of let's get rid of the Johnny Come Lately fans who only enjoyed that radio, you know, those radio hits from Nevermind, then yeah, mission accomplished. But man, even hardcore fans would be hard pressed to enjoy this one right off the bat.
Yeah, this sounds like it couldn't make the cut on Bleach to me.
Yeah.
This is a very early replacement sounding kind of song, even the way it's recorded. Hats off to Steve Albini. I think the drums from the get-go sound amazing on this record.
Yes.
I will say this right now, from beginning to end, if any issue I have with this record, it's definitely not the production. I think he did a good job.
I'm with you. Totally with you.
Cobain, though, I mean, I'll say this. You talked about how sloppy it was. He's always had this sound. It sounds like he's not very good at guitar, the way his sound is. The fact of the matter is that really is his vibe, and it's difficult to replicate. Like, you couldn't, like a guy like Warren DeMartini, who people think, oh, that guy is fucking amazing, he couldn't do this. He literally wouldn't be able to play this and make it sound like this. This song, as sloppy as it sound, if you click along to it, it is very tight, and there's that kind of that weird feedback and all that kind of stuff. But as for an actual song, this is boring as shit, man. It's a horrible record opener. I don't care if you're trying to distance yourself from the casual fan this hard, you're probably a little too committed to the bit. And I've said that about Kurt before when in reference to marrying Courtney Love.
Nice one.
But it sounds like a UK B-side to me. The lead single for a posthumous greatest hits record. That's what I would call this. This is just a bad song.
So this is funny. You had reached out months in advance, and I had given you what I came up with the rating system, and I kept listening to every episode religiously, thinking someone's going to come up with this, and I'm going to sound like a poser, but nobody did, so I was happy. The rating system I came up with was days without washing your hair. So five being perfectly grungy and zero being way too clean, you're a poser. Now, I did also come up with 0 through 5 puddle of muds.
Number 2!
All right, I'm sticking with my original days without washing your hair.
All right, well, how many days without washing hair does this song get?
This one is 1.5 days, so, you know, you're taking your shower later in the day. Only because of the guitar solo, otherwise it might have been 0, so.
Well, then, as far as I'm concerned, he might as well have just stepped out of the fucking shower.
Awesome.
This one gets a 0 from me. I think this is only my second or third 0. I recently stumbled across the CD copy of this about 2 months ago. I was like, well, I'm going to be talking about this, and it's $2. I might as well buy it. Man, the first I don't think I ever heard the whole thing back in the day. Like I said, I was not a fan. I did own Nevermind, but that was it. But Jesus Christ, this song, no.
No.
Let's get to track 2. I'm probably for most of this, I'm just going to let you, you know, sometimes I like to go back and forth with who goes first. I don't know if that's going to work this week. What do you got for Scentless Apprentice?
We'll be right back.
this is a better song, but even this song tests my patience. Yeah. Yeah, because you get the distorted red line chorus, if you can call it a chorus. The initial drum beat and the, I do like the intro riff. That kind of saves the song for me. Okay. The riff is great. I do love, like you said, the rich, full drum sound from Dave Grohl. By far the highlight of this album. But I swear, I thought I needed a new stereo.
Let me pause you there.
Yeah, sure.
Imagine some of those great hair metal records or
yes.
Whatever term people want, where they just got rid of that just super reverb snare. If they had this drum sound, we would definitely view that whole genre differently. That one thing would just change the cheesiness of so much of what they did.
Totally agree. Absolutely. Okay. But I swear, the first time I heard this song, I thought I needed a new stereo because, my speakers are going out because of this shit. So, and it's a cassette. So, in any case, this could have been
The van's kind of going up a hill, and the power's lagging a little bit on the from the back.
Trying to reconnect and in any case, this could have been a more highly rated track for me if not for the abrasive chorus. And I don't mind screaming vocals. For example, Pantera's one of my favorite bands.
Sure.
And I love Slayer and Tom Araya, but this is just painful. And I understand wanting to create a vibe that scares away the fair weather fans, but being abrasive just to be quote unquote extreme, it's cutting off your nose despite your face. And in this case, it's more akin to Van Gogh, because I'd like to at least have one good ear to focus on the guitar riff, and then I can tune out the vocals with the one I just cut off. So that's Scentless Apprentice for me.
This is the only song credited to all three members of the band. The song was inspired by, I just actually, true story, I was doing some last minute research in prep for this. I watched a YouTube video with one of the last interviews from Kurt Cobain, and he said this song is about a book he has read, like, I don't know, 10 times. He says he keeps it. And he reads it on planes, and he always finds something about himself in it. But it's a novel called Perfume by an author called Patrick Susskind. It's about a man born with an amazing sense of smell, but no smell of his own. I'm not really sure what that means, but he was an apprentice in a perfume shop and becomes a murderer of young girls for their scent. sadly, there's a 9-minute version of this somewhere out there, and that just sounds... That sounds miserable.
Yes.
You know what? I'll cut to the lead here. This gets a generous 2 days without showering from me.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. I gave it a two days as well, and mostly because of the intro riff. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much to read. I agreed. Basically, other than the things I said, what you said.
Okay.
Ditto.
Touche. Yes, ditto.
All right. Well, up next, I think hopefully we turn a little bit of a more positive corner here.
I think so.
Is the lead single Heart-Shaped Box.
She has me like a Pisces when I am weak. I've been locked inside your heart-shaped box.
Okay, kids, you've eaten some of your vegetables on your plate and most of your dinner. So to reward you, we're going to give you dessert. We're going to give you a track that at least, you know, resembles the qualities you kind of liked on Nevermind. So it's obvious why this was the first single and arguably, you know, the most popular song on the album. Because, again, it's got all the great qualities from Nevermind. The chorus is super catchy. The vocals are rough, but they're in tune. And it's really a great song. I appreciate even more, especially after the painful first two tracks. And besides the chorus, the way the vocals are kind of layered with those different tones, that's what stands out for me. Ironically, it's kind of similar to what Axl Rose used to do with his vocals on some of the tracks on Appetite. So even though Kurt would kind of, you know, demonize Axl for everything wrong with rock stardom, mostly correct, catchy hooks and well-produced music from talented musicians can still be appreciated in the art of creating music. And I think even Kurt would understand that, and he kind of displays that in Heart Shaped Box. So this gets 5 days without, you know, washing your hair. So this is perfectly grungy.
I actually believe that Guns N' Roses kind of set the table for grunge.
Really?
They kind of, if you think about the timeline there, they were, and the way they broke and the way they connected with people that weren't listening, like they didn't just appeal to the fans of Poison and Dokken and Rat. You know what I mean? They appealed to that guy at high school that didn't buy anything. You know what I mean?
It's right.
Like, you know, the jocks, the nerds, everybody kind of got into them. And that's kind of what grunge did, is that it was more inclusive. So I think they were kind of that first domino, as much as it took a few years and there was still your Bang Tangos and stuff like that to come. It all eventually kind of worked its way out. But back to this song. Yeah, this is the obvious single, right? Like, you listen to this record with an objective ear. This stands out, you know, definitely.
Yeah.
For the first time, you know, at this point in the record, we're three tracks in. This sounds like the growth that I expected from Nirvana. Like, if I was a casual fan, this is the first song I heard. I'm like, this sounds like a step forward from Nevermind, while they still kind of maintain who they are as a band.
Right.
Many believe it is written about his shaky but passionate relationship with much maligned Courtney Love. The lyrics do kind of lead towards that, since they seem to concern themselves with, like, I don't know, two unstable individuals. But it's worth noting that the lyrics mention Pisces and Cancer, and apparently that's Courtney's and Cobain's respected astrological signs. I like this song. As somebody who is not a fan of the band, I should say, I think this is a great song. This also gives 5 days with no shower.
Yeah, and I think this is when we go back to, you know, was I looking forward to In Utero? Yeah, when I heard Heart-Shaped Box, I'm like, this is the natural extension of Nevermind. So, and then we get to the album. So.
All right. Well, next up is Sam Walton's favorite track on the record, Rape Me.
Rape me. Rape me, my friend. Rape me. Rape me again. I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one.
Well, it's funny you brought up the story. I had no idea about that, but if I was sequencing the tracks, I would have started the album with Rape Me for a few reasons. It would have been funny because it's essentially the same intro as Smells Like Teen Spirit. So this would delight and possibly piss off the music critics who didn't get the humor in it. Another reason is that having a first track called Rape Me, a little dark, you know, your Walmart crowd would definitely be horrified. And finally, it's also one of the better, catchier songs on the album. It would have still accomplished scaring off the crowd as intended, but at least given those that enjoy melodies in their music something to appreciate. I think it was a total lost opportunity, in my opinion. The vocals and the chorus, again, are really reminiscent of Nevermind, which is good for me. The positive in Utero that I recognized from the first time I heard the album, again, the drums, they are enormous. And being that I enjoyed, like, Eric Carr on Creatures of the Night, I liked a similar sort of drum heaviness for a grunge band that I don't think grunge really kind of always paid attention to the drums in grunge recordings. I'm curious how you feel about that.
Actually, you know, that's one of the things that as I've gone through this little journey of mine, that I've realized, especially with the Big Four, just how amazing the drummers are. Even a guy like Dale Crover from the Melvins, I mean, just you couldn't get a more perfect drummer for what the Melvins do. And he's actually a phenomenal drummer. He's different. He approaches it in almost a prog way. But I don't think I appreciated at the time how great Dave Grohl was as a drummer. He is actually 1A or 1B of my two favorite rock drummers, the other being Tommy Lee. As much as mm-hmm. a dipshit he is, I think he's an amazing rock and roll drummer, a hard rock drummer anyway, however you want to put that. But look at Matt Cameron, fucking probably the gold standard for the big four. Even though he ended up going to Pearl Jam, those first couple Pearl Jam drummers, even though David Bruzzese is kind of a dipshit, he's a drummer, man. Hits things with sticks. But he was phenomenal on there. Even though he was like the second drummer, and then of course, who am I leaving out? Sean Kinney, just a killer drummer. All these guys had monsters, and that's the one thing everybody wants to talk about. Like, well, really, they're just kind of metal. It's like, yeah, but. How is it that they ended up getting with producers that understood that they weren't going to do this with the drums? You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, how come all these other metal bands ended up with guys who like made them sound like stereotypical metal drummers? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. No, totally agree.
So that's my thoughts on the drummers. Yeah, I mm-hmm. don't think I paid much attention to it at the time, but going through this whole thing, there's so many things that pop up that it's really been a lot of fun to also remember, like just relive that time of my life and that kind of stuff, but also to learn so much about things that I overlooked, I guess. So, and drummers are definitely one of them. But back to Rape Me. Well, you know, Kurt's always been kind of a progressive kind of guy when it came to the rights of females and stuff like that. This is a song about a guy rapes a girl and then he ends up in jail and gets raped there, right?
Right.
Did you give your rating?
I give it four days without washing your hair.
Okay, yeah, I'm not too far behind you on there. I'm 3.5 days without you know, I wake up in the morning a little hungover, and halfway through the day, I take like a shower at 2:00. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So. Exactly.
And by the way, you sold me. I think it should have been the opener. When you first opened up with that whole theory, I was like, eh. And then by the end of it, I was like, yeah, he's got a great point. This is perfect. Well done, bro.
It would have been fun. I think that would have been hilarious because it basically is smells like Teen Spirit and, you know, kind of subdued. So,
well, track five, we have
a mouthful.
Another Fallout Boy song title here. Frances Farmer will have her revenge on Seattle.
Yes, I'm relieving. Now that you're leaving, soon as you can think. It's all relaxing, here that you're resting, never again soon. It's all soothing, now that you're assuming, soon as it's all myself.
Kurt's vocals, his sloppy vocals, they work on some tracks and they drag on others. This is a dragger for me. Again, though, Dave Grohl, his drum work saves this from being a complete loss because the middle breakdown riffs they're cool. I do remember at the time listening to this for the first time, being kind of proud of myself at 15 for, again, not spending the extra $10 to buy this on CD compared to cassette. So five songs in. One good thing is I did look up Frances Farmer, and this is pre-internet. I must have either saw a bio about her or something in the TV listings, and so I watched the biopic with that stars Jessica Lange about Frances Farmer. It's just called Frances.
Wow.
Came out in 1982. So very interesting life.
You only get this kind of insight from the host of the goddamn
That's right. We're going to have to change that in 2021. God damn. But very interesting life that Frances Farmer. If you want to spend a couple hours, watching something about mental illness and shock therapy of an actress in the 1930s, it's very, very interesting. And Jessica Lange was kind of an underrated actress. I think they kind of only remember her from, that King Kong movie. But she's a very good actress. And,
she killed it in American Horror Story.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And my Lord, you know, I'm that show got worse every year, especially after she left.
For the song, I give it 2.5 days. Again, I'm waking up at 2 o'clock like you are. It's time to wash the hair. So
there's some really annoying feedback in that pre-chorus, but other than that, mm-hmm. I think it actually is one of the better tracks on here. But it's still forgettable. Yep. I give it 3 days without showering.
Okay.
Or washing your hair, sorry.
Washing your hair, yes. I mean, you could just wash your hair in the sink, so we could do
good
that.
Good point.
So, we're getting ready to flip the cassette here. The last track on side one is Dumb.
I'm not like them, that can pretend. The sun is gone, and I have a light. The day is done, and I'm having fun. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy. Think I'm just happy. Think I'm just happy. Think I'm just happy.
This is actually a great song, and I love the use of violins on the track. For me, Kurt's vocals work.
That's a cello.
Oh, sorry. There you go. See, this is why I stick with movies and you do that. So the strings. For me, Kurt's vocals work much better when he's somewhat restrained, or he kind of uses his natural rasp in his voice for kind of a more soulful use, like he did on Unplugged, you know, like Where Did You Sleep Last Night? I think Dumb would have also fit very well on Nevermind. It's kind of similar to Something in the Way or even Polly, especially the middle breakdown. This is also a great radio-friendly song without being obvious. It's short. It's catchy. I think it's tasteful. Again, the layered vocals, they're really well done. It's also obvious why they would pick this song for the Unplugged show. So this gets a 5 days without washing your hair.
Now, the cello was performed courtesy of a lady named Kira Shally, hopefully I'm getting her name correct there. Mm-hmm. If not, look me up and hunt me down. Anyway, she also appears later on All Apologies, so when we get to there, it's the same cellist.
Ah.
The one thing I like about the song, and Kurt's actually very good at this, is it's lyrically, it can be interpreted a bunch of different ways. Is it sarcastic? Is it self-deprecating? Mm-hmm. He's very skilled lyrically when he wants to be. And he reminds me a lot of Paul Westerberg when it comes to that kind of... I call it the Minnesota snark, but it's just... Pretty much anybody who lives in a northern climate that kind of sucks, snark, is probably what I should be calling it. But either way, this song, I get... Now, this is one of those examples where I kind of understand why people like it and I don't. Like, it's a difference between... It's basically just taste, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually a pretty good song. It definitely, like you said, it harkens back to Nevermind Polly. It kind of had that kind of vibe to it. But for me, personally, this is a 3 days without washing my hair.
Okay, yeah.
All right, well, as you're fast-forwarding the cassette to get to side two, let's get into a little bit of some other details I had. I like to talk about anyway. Initially,
sure.
When Nirvana started, they split publishing evenly amongst the three of them. But after the success of Nevermind, Cobain insisted on a 75-25 split, which is probably the first sign of cracks. There was rumors that like they were going to, at the very least, take a break, if not break up, after the In Utero tour. So I'm not sure where that would, if that this had to be like one of the first things. There was all sorts of issues going on. Maybe we'll get into some of that. But future Foo Fighter Pat Smear would join as a touring guitarist. This is kind of where he comes into the picture. Kurt's heroin abuse was running out of control on the ensuing tour. Novoselic basically said that much in 2015 that he was out of his mind on heroin the final days. In March he got sick and they took a break and he was basically Courtney was in Rome, so he went to Rome while the other guys went back to the States. He had like pneumonia or something like that. And while there, he attempted suicide. And shortly after that, he flew back to the States. And we kind of know what happens next. You know, he gets home, and a couple weeks later, he's found dead. The couple things that I found here, those close to Cobain fought desperately to save him from himself. Cobain's mom and other worried relatives actually staged an intervention at one point. And for a moment, there seemed to be some a glimmer of hope as he agreed to go to a treatment facility in Los Angeles. He, in the words of what I've read here in an interview, or in an article, I should say, on his last days, he escaped 2 days later. if it's right, it says he hopped a 6-foot wall. That's pretty much an escape. And of course, several days later, he was found dead. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Duff McKagan's book, but he says they were on the flight home that together to Seattle that Kurt took after breaking out of that. But and of course, we all know his body was found on April 8th by an electrician. He had a shotgun laying on there, and they had a suicide note in the house somewhere, I think.
Yeah.
And it said something like, at the end, it's better to burn out than fade away. So I'm guessing he was really into pyromania. Before I get into some of my standard questions, was there anything about that kind of thing that all the things that you wanted to chime in on?
Yeah, I mean, I think being that age, I think a lot of people remember, you know, some people remember Kennedy, some people remember Lennon. I definitely remember being at home. I think it was on the weekend. I believe it was a Saturday, and just kind of being shocked because I don't recall many bands
that
was really
because I was home.
Yeah. And so I don't remember, you know, at least my young age, any musicians I was really listening to at the time dying. And so that it was weird. It was kind of surreal and didn't make sense. And, I'm 15 at the time. So if I maybe, you know, dug a little deeper, it would have made sense. But yeah, it was just strange. And then like a typical 15-year-old was like, okay, now I'm going to go to a San Francisco Giants game. Like life moves on. But yeah, it was a weird, weird time.
Have you seen any of those, we'll call them finger quote documentaries where they basically imply that Courtney arranged to have him killed?
Yeah, the whole El Duce.
That one's really out there. But there's another one that has a private investigator who actually has some recordings with her that honestly comes off a little more legit. But the problem is it's like a lot of documentaries. It has an agenda and only shows the evidence that supports that, nothing else. You know what I mean?
Of course. And I had read a book for Nirvana. It's escaping me right now. But, you know, I guess Kurt really had bad stomach issues, and I guess that's part of the reason he took heroin so much. And he just couldn't take the pain for that horrible...
I've never bought that. It very well could be true, but maybe... Uh-huh. Heroin abuse caused some stomach issues.
Agreed. It can't be good for your stomach, but hey, what do I know? But
is heroin good for an upset stomach, or does it cause the? It's like I honestly don't know, though. Like I shouldn't make light of it. It's just been a long time. I just have always junkies are junkies, and that doesn't mean they're not human beings. It doesn't mean they deserve to die. And he could not have been in a clear state of mind if he was all hopped up. And frankly, these type of stories, as I've gone through this, they do almost take a toll. On myself, it's like Jesus, this shit gets dark at times. You almost forget because you're like you said, you went to a Giants game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I remember kind of like I was like I said, this wasn't even my guy, and I was like, this is huge. What the hell?
Go ahead.
I'm off to the bar.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's also maybe the charm of living pre-internet. I didn't have really a chance to dwell on it. Maybe MTV was doing stuff around the clock, but get away from it. Yeah, and so like
I'm getting all of it in a compressed time. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like Lane died a decade later, Chris Cornell a decade after that. All these little people in between. I shouldn't say little. All the others that have fallen in between. I'm doing this over the course of a year, and I'm like, holy fuck! I forgot how devastating that drug and was to that scene in particular. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I also want to, speaking, and we'll kind of go off a little bit of a tangent, thank you for recommending that Alice in Chains book. It is so good. I'm about really halfway through, and I'm at facelift right now, but I loved hearing like the early years. And that was a great recommendation.
Yeah, and if you're listening, David DeSola, that's one sale. I can take credit.
Definitely a sale. I purchase all my books. So yes.
what a great guest he was. He's coming. We've already recorded it, but there's a segment for the Dirt episode that
excellent.
We'll get into more of that. And I actually think there's a lot more fun stuff there. But
great.
He was great in the first one. Well, Let's segue a little bit and get into some more of the lighter fare here. So what were you listening to? What was your jam prior to grunge breaking?
Aerosmith, AC/DC, Zeppelin, Sabbath. That's what I was absolutely into at the time. And Nirvana and Alice
as a 13-year-old, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it's all my dad. My dad just had music all around the house, and they had
vinyl.
Were
you listening to current Sabbath?
No. The first Sabbath tape I got it wasn't really Sabbath. It was Ozzy. It was Speak of the Devil, it was all Sabbath songs live. And so that was my introduction. Then I went back and got the debut, which is definitely the heaviest blues influence they ever had, and then got Paranoid and everything else after that. So, but Aerosmith was natural because Aerosmith definitely their 70s stuff is so bluesy. Of course, AC/DC and Zeppelin. So, it was like the natural evolution of rock anyway. And I kind of followed that. So, but I still to this day listen to Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Johnny Hooker. And that's what I'm into. And so, that's never changed. My musical taste got heavier and heavier as I got along. But yeah, those were kind of my wheelhouse bands at that point in the early 90s.
And you mentioned that your chubby side action dubbed you a copy of Nirvana Nevermind.
Yeah.
Timing wise, I don't know if you made this clear. So if you did, I apologize. But did you jump in kind of full blast into grunge, or did that kind of ease you in where you kind of started pulling in the other act?
I think it was eased. Yeah. And again, I think MTV had a lot to do with it too, because you couldn't avoid the big bands at the time. So, I think right after that, I got.
Do you hate Pearl Jam?
No, not at all. I really only liked the first three albums. After that, I kind of lost interest. But 10, I was all in on 10. I think baby. I got a gift card or a gift certificate. It was a real paper certificate to the warehouse and bought 10 that Christmas. And so, that's definitely and Alice in Chains, I think, again, that was of the four major ones. That was by far my favorite because I think they were the closest to what I was into musically at the time. But the Nirvana fit in. But I think I always enjoyed, I didn't care that people thought I was weird for listening to this, amazing blues music. I was like, well, you don't get it. And so I like what you guys like. It's not that I hate Def Leppard or Whitesnake, and I love early Whitesnake, but that's fine. You guys listen to what you're listening to, I'll listen to mine. If you don't like it, don't ride in the van. So
get out of the van.
Yeah,
put
get out of the van.
Fucking Whitesnake, bitch.
Yeah, that's right.
Come and get it.
That's right.
That's the best I could do for an early reference there.
Ready and willing.
Well, here's the question. Of course, I'm pretty sure you've been counting down the moments to the show that you need
absolutely
to answer. And that is, did grunge kill hair metal?
Yeah, and everyone, I'm not going to stray too far from what everyone's pretty much had a very thoughtful, good answer. And no, I don't. I think all genres of music go through phases. It's like saying, did rock and roll kill big band music or the crooners, like Sinatra and Perry Como in the 50s? No, those artists still had their place and their fans, but then the focus changed on how the record labels would promote, those newer, more exciting genres. They changed. And so every genre of music runs its course. Hair metal, I think you've said it perfectly. Hair metal lasted a lot longer than most genres. And the hair bands that were not A-list, they suffered, but they were going to probably gradually fade regardless of if it was grunge or any new sort of music came in. So, and plus, grunge had been around for years already. Why didn't it kill off hair metal in 88? Just like the blues were around for years when it eventually evolved into rock and roll.
There's a fresh take.
There you go. And, look, I think even the all-time great bands.
The simple answer is it wasn't as good then.
fair enough, actually. But even the all-time great bands, the rock bands, had drops in album sales. Look at Zeppelin. Not every album was going to be Led Zeppelin 4. 3 didn't do as well as 2. Presence didn't do as well as Physical Graffiti. And the drop in album sales wasn't all of a sudden because disco became popular. It was just they ran their course in a certain way, but they were still very, very popular and I think, you know, Bon Jovi survived, whether I like their what they turned into. You don't see any of them complaining, God, fucking Nirvana just ruined our career. No, it's the sea level bands that died off. So, yes, that there's my answer to that.
You know, much like we took a more bluesier approach with this record for the hair metal bands. The cliche response for them now is to talk about, like, I loved grunge. I thought it was great for music, you know.
Right.
Or that's the one cliche. The other one is, they destroyed, and now I had to sell my house. You know? Or it's an easy escape for a bad record. You know what I mean?
It's an easy scapegoat because it's.
But the reality was, I was 20, 21 when all this happened. After fucking Nirvana, Warrant could have wrote fucking Abbey Road and it would have fucking been treated the same. So,
right. Exactly. Yeah. And it was funny because you connected to Guns N' Roses. It didn't bother them at all. If anything, it might have helped them.
Tesla did okay. They had their biggest success after Nevermind with Psychotic Jam.
Oh, yeah, and Five Man Acoustical Jam. And I think Bustin' Nut's a great album, and that still sold a half million albums.
That didn't do very good.
I think it sold over 500,000, but yeah, compared to everything else,
you might be the only person who ever said it was a great album.
Yeah, even Brian Weed agrees with you. I just finished his book. So.
Oh, is it good?
I he's definitely honest. He dishes dirt on everyone, so if you like that, it's a good read.
All right. Yeah, I heard him interviewed on my close personal friend Ron Keel's show, I was actually looking to get that book, but your recommendation pushes it over the top.
Well, if you're a fan, I've been a fan of Tesla a long time.
Not a huge Brian Wheat fan though, you know, bass player.
He talks about that. He doesn't really consider himself a great bass player at all. He's much more proud of his producing and kind of running the band now. He's like kind of the band's manager. So,
well, should we flip the tape?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So now, are we heading down that kind of? I've never been to San Francisco, so are we gonna put the tape in, kind of put it in neutral, and just zigzag down that big hill that's famous?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, if the car hasn't stalled by now, which fun story, that actually did happen with my mom and sister, and my sister to this day is scared of San Francisco hills because it started to kind of fall back, and luckily she got it started in time because good times. Like kind of scarred from.
You would
from
actually
that.
Think manual transmissions would be popular there because there's so many places to easily pop the clutch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love driving the stick, but once traffic became more insane because of Silicon Valley, I don't want to sit in traffic with the stick shift any longer.
Oh, I'm with you. You know, I think I'm glad I got to drive one for a long time. And I think it's a fun thing to learn and actually a good – it teaches you how to drive a little better, I believe it.
Oh, I agree.
But it's almost like it's almost like one of those – like as you get older, you want more conveniences in life.
Absolutely.
I've earned it. You know what I mean?
Yes. I don't have to buy if you're a person that likes alcohol, why buy shitty liquor when I can afford something a little bit better?
There you go. Yeah.
Yep.
Was that a cheap shot because I'm drinking Coors Light?
Not at all. I mean, that's good. Yeah.
It's all good, man. All right. So we're heading down the hill and the tape opens up with Very Ape.
Great fall in by Dave Grohl with the drums. It really pushes the song forward. And it sounds like one of the kind of stray tracks from Incesticide. Kurt doesn't go off the rails with his screaming on the chorus. I think that's kind of a relief. And here's one where I wish it was a little bit longer because I think that it could have done some interesting things if it went on about a minute or so more. And I felt at the time, and I still do now, it's a really frustrating album. The songs that aren't great seem really lazy and for whatever reason kind of pushed up front just to kind of be annoying. Okay. Whereas when they have a real strong song for me, like Very Ape, they don't bother to push it further. And it's kind of buried in the track ordering, even though if you bought it on cassette, it does lead it off. So maybe that's part of the reason. But that being said, I give it a 4. It would have been higher, but I kind of felt cheated by the short length.
I think the length is perfect. I think that ties into that whole punk thing.
Yeah,
And I enjoy that. I'm actually a big fan of punk music, and I like those elements that they kept. I've heard people talk about them as like they're more really just a pop band and all this stuff. And I'm like, I've always felt, basically from the first time hearing Teen Spirit and the rest of that record, that Nirvana at its core was like a early 80s punk band kind of thing like that. They really, you know, look, I think I've explained in the show plenty of times, I'm fine with kind of a wide umbrella over the term grunge and what that means. It could mean the Lemonheads to Nirvana, that kind of thing. But if you want to get to the core, I think they are more, they've always been more punk. And punk, the best punk bands always had a little bit of a hook and a pop sensibility to it. So I think people, because it never really broke like Nirvana did, people, you know, don't think about it in that sense. They just think about it in much like that movie we're going to be talking about, where it's just abrasive, you know, antisocial attitude about everything. But this song didn't do much for me, though.
Okay.
the brevity, maybe that's why I like the brevity, is like, just get it over with.
Right.
Look, Kurt has always kind of attacked, you know, that, I don't know, fragile masculinity or the macho shit, you know, in his lyrics. I've always felt on that topic specifically, he comes off a little bit disingenuous. Like, he's almost jealous. Like, he's like, it's easy to make fun of something you can't be. It's like, oh, look at Michael Jordan dunking basketballs. That's all he does. You know, you know, it's like, well, I mean, if you could do it, wouldn't you? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And if he kind of lived that ethos, you mentioned how he kind of changed the One for All band to, yeah, I'm writing all the music now. I'm good shit. So now you get 75%. So I think Kurt, he's a product of, at the time you act a certain way because you have to. So
yeah, and I can't remember if it was Jack and Dino. I think it was Jack and Dino I was talking to. But I was surprised to find out that Kurt specifically actually had this grandiose, like, huge rock star goal in mind. You know what I mean? Like, because as much as he wanted to stay true to himself, there was part of him that was like, I want to get the brass ring. And I don't fault him for that. I think that I think that's fantastic. I think it makes him more human. But it was surprising because he is so into that, like, I'm not going to shower for 5 days. That's how good this song is. but this song, he took a shower after 2 days. So,
yep, fair enough.
All right. Well, number 8, second track on side 2. Let's flip it over. Milk It. Get into the lyrics a little bit because I have no idea what the fuck he's talking about.
Okay.
The lyrics are, they open up with, I am my own parasite. I don't need a host to live. We feed off each other. We can share our endorphins. Dull steak, test meat. Look on the bright side, suicide. Lost eyesight, I'm on your side. I don't hate the lyrics, but I just don't know where he's going.
Yeah, no clue. I'm absolutely no clue. And at 15, I'm pretty much no different at 42. Where there's certain songs I just don't.
Man, this really speaks to me.
Yeah, I'm like, whatever. Like, is it does it pique my interest in the sense of, does it work for the song? No. So no, I have no opinion about the actual lyrics.
Well, any other thought?
Well, I have plenty to say about the song. It's a combination of the first two songs, which, you know, Serve the Servants and Sentinelless Apprentice, and it's like, why do you get this out of tune garbage from Served combined with the massive drums and actually interesting riffage of Scentless, but there's just something off where you just know in the beginning they're going to fuck up the song. And and yes, my instincts are correct. Kurt's mumbling. I'm glad you said the lyrics, almost strung out soft vocals. And then he just vomits out all the toxins during the chorus. It's like it destroys any semblance of a decent song.
Vomit.
Look, I am anti-corporate suits in the music business. The guys who don't necessarily understand art, they just care about the bottom line of numbers and revenue. But if I worked at a label and I heard some of this shit, I'd start to wonder how far we let these guys go, because I'm not getting it and I'm a fan. So yeah. Plus, we might want to take some of the budget and reassign it to rehab costs, because Kurt's not sounding good, especially the guitar solo that sounds like him retuning his guitar. I mean, Jesus Christ, or Jesus Chrysler is we should promote Jesus Chrysler. So I give it one. I give it a one.
Ah, hey, I beat you on this one. He goes 2 days without showering in this one. Well, the next track, Pennyroyal Tea, and I'll tip it to you, but before I do, I will say that according to WebMD, Pennyroyal Tea is able to help you when you need to fight a chill brought on by sickness. And it is very soothing to the digestive system, stomach issues. It also induces indigestion and gas and helps calm colonic spasms. But it can also be used to induce an abortion. If drank in large doses, it can kill you. Which direction do you think Kurt's going here?
He should have just taken a shower instead of drinking this stuff. But I don't know. Where do you think he's going?
It has to be a metaphor. You know what I mean? He's not using it literally for the, like, I don't think Pennyroyal Tea is something that doctors are prescribing currently. But, it's like more of that kind of like turn of the century kind of shit.
I don't know. Some of the early coronavirus vaccines sounded much like Pennyroyal Tea. So.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Nice.
Not the ones now. We're recording in early 2021.
So. New Year's Day, baby. Happy New Year, Brian.
That's right. Drink some Pennyroyal Tea. But I forgot how much this studio version just sucks. Like, the unplugged version... the unplugged version is so much better for me. It's not even close. And this is where Kurt's vocals are just... garbage. But when he hones in his vocals, which I think he did for the unplugged version, I think it's powerful and moving. Here, it just sounds, the song itself sounds sloppy, it's tuneless, it's completely stupid, and it's a real bait and switch, because I think the first 30 seconds of the song, when he kind of has the restrained vocals, the acoustic guitar, that's where the song should have remained. But then they went and fucked it up. I think it's complete garbage. The reason I'm giving it a 1 instead of a 0 is because there is a structure of a good song, and I think kind of Unplugged kind of proved that.
Yeah, at this point, I'm waiting for something to grab my attention and make it memorable, and it keeps being a swing and a miss. This gets a 2 from me for largely what you just said at the end there. There is a structure of a song here. Mm-hmm. It's just... I drank too much Pennyroyal Tea and now I'm vomiting. I induced some kind of like weird, I don't know, male abortion or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
All right. Well, let's pick it up here. Go to Radio Friendly Unit Shifter.
Oh, no. Here we go again. Let's record Kurt wanking away with the feedback. I realize Geffen didn't want to piss off their cash cow, but wow. What didn't make the album if this was a keeper? It gets a little bit better, mostly because
of Dave
Grohl. You're
telling me this record would suffer without this 4 minutes and 51 seconds?
Exactly. Yeah. And the song gets a little bit better, and it only because of Dave Grohl and the drum sound. Mm. But Kurt's completely useless here. The slurring vocal style, it's completely out of tune. He's got a tone-deaf chorus. And seriously, if In Utero had come out instead of Nevermind, they wouldn't even have had a chance to record a third album. If the vocals were somewhat decent, this could have been actually a pretty good song, because I think the bass and the drums do work.
Okay.
But the structure of the riff works, and then Kurt goes and screws it all up with the scratching feedback bullshit. So this gets a one.
Well, according to Kurt, this song was a throwaway, and I would like to add, much like the rest of the album, ba-boom!
Any royalty.
Yeah, this gets two for me. All right, well, track 11 is Tourette's.
Just when you think it couldn't get any worse. Definitely a fitting title. I'd personally rather hear Amy Poehler yell random obscenities in Deuce Bigelow and Male Gigolo than this pile of shit.
That's hilarious because you brought that up.
I mean, seriously, I'd rather hear Amy yell, shove it up your ass, or ball sweat, or, you know, anus licker, you know, goat nipple biter, vulva, you know, jizz trap, and my all-time favorite, shit whore, because that's the form of Tourette's.
Ooh, shit whore.
I think that's much more enjoyable than Nirvana. What we should do with this song is kind of what Rob Schneider's character does with Amy, and that's take her to the baseball game. Play it at the baseball game when your favorite team gives up a home run to the opposing team, because the anger and the uselessness of this song could be used in some sort of positive way. I mean, God damn it. How did this make the album? This is Puddle of Mud bad. This gets a zero. Mm. You're washing with Perel.
Wow, zero. Have you ever known someone with Tourette's?
Yeah, actually. Yeah.
I can't believe that. It always seemed like it was literally a made-up disorder for comedic purposes.
Right.
For Adam Sandler movies is what I wrote down, and you brought up the one example I had, Deuce Bigelow. But honest to God, tell me, like, the person you knew that had Tourette's, was it all just spitting out curse words?
No, it was more like, definitely the curse words were there. But it was also kind of like tics. Like there would be certain, very similar to OCD. And I wasn't mature enough to really, I wasn't mean, but I also kind of like, this is funny, but it's not funny. You know, I knew it at an early age, but, I think once medication kind of got better and more evolved, and they could handle it better, but it wasn't as, you know, in Deuce Bigelow, it's actually pretty funny, and it was kind of, you know, well used to, you know, take her to a baseball game and have her yell at hitters, you know. But it's a very interesting disorder.
I can't even give this a zero. I'm in detox, and I shower every 15 minutes because there's nothing else to do but masturbate in the shower. He is so bad. So negative four.
Yeah. You're in a sauna, or you're just constantly
you're
washing yourself,
constantly shampooing your hair.
Yes.
Well, the album closes out. We're almost at our destination, wherever we're going. And where are we going? Haight-Ashbury? Is that San Francisco?
I guess. I don't know. That's definitely the place to get more grungier. At least it was before Silicon Valley invaded San Francisco. So,
well, fair enough. But the album closes with All Apology.
What else should I be? Apologies.
Yeah, this is, as you might, as you've heard, this is a frustrating album, to say the least. Kind of like Pennyroyal Tea, the unplugged version of All Apologies is far superior to the studio version. But unlike Pennyroyal Tea, the electric version of All Apologies isn't complete garbage. It's actually a well-crafted, good song. But it's a weird way to end the album. I don't know what song would have been a better, ending track. But yeah, it's a good song. It's kind of tarnished with the muddy, grungy guitars instead of allowing, the strings and the cello and percussion of the unplugged version to kind of shine. So not the worst, and I give it a 3.
All right. Well, in this instance, I think there was one other one earlier. It might have been Dumb. I will concede. I get how people may dig this track, but this is complete shit to me. This song is so fucking annoying. I just want it to stop.
Excuse me.
At least the record is over, and I got really nothing else. This gets a 1 day. Like he's pretty freshly coiffed.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, before we get into your final thoughts on In Utero, Brian, are there any records that didn't make the list that you felt belonged in the top 25?
Absolutely. There's at least four. Mother Love Bones, Apple.
Oh, yes. Totally agree.
The Stooges Funhouse. Alice in Chains, Jar of Flies. And then the one that's criminally didn't make it was Louder Than Love.
Ultra Mega OK. I did not get that at all, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That was Rolling Stone trying to be hip when, they're not. So
a little bit.
Those were the four that I think from 26 through 50 should have been in the top 25.
Yeah, I would agree with. I don't know the Stooges record, so I just don't know what to say there. But the other three, Absolutely, I could put them ahead of plenty of records on here. All right, well, as I like to do, I like to give the guest host the last word. So I'll give my parting shots here on this gem of a record. I do think it's important one last time to remind the listener that Nirvana never really clicked with me because I just want to expose my bias a little bit. Maybe somebody's listening to this and is like, what a fucking asshole. Look, I appreciate what they did, and I'm not a hater. It's just not my cup of tea. So it is safe to say this record wasn't made for somebody with me in mind is all I'm getting at there. However, I do know the difference between something that's bad and something that just isn't my thing. And I think this record is bad. I think picking Heart-Shaped Box as a lead single is the easiest job anybody who ever had to do that ever had to do. It was like nothing else stands out as much as that does. That is the diamond in a goddamn cow turd as far as I'm concerned. It stands far above the rest of the record.
I
prefer the unplugged version of All Apologies, and I hate that version. To me, I agree with what you said, though. I think it's light years better. But and I think I mentioned it, I don't blame Steve Albini, as I think the production, it's not amazing, but it's not bad. It's a well-produced record. It's the songs. And maybe it was that Kurt was really in a bad place. We all know where things went after this. Let's not forget, like, there was some issues leading up to this related to his drugs, where his kid was taken away from him because of his and Courtney's, heroin use and stuff. So we're seeing a person that's probably not physically and mentally and even chemically in an appropriate place. And maybe that's to blame for a lot of this, because as much as, like, I don't really go to Nevermind as my jam, I totally appreciate the genius that record is.
Sure.
But yeah, so to me, it's the songs. It's the songs, because everything else, the other two members of the band delivered exactly as you would hope. It's just not a good record. And this slides for me all the way from number 8 to 24.
Okay.
Brian?
Yeah, I think you can go extreme and heavy on albums and still have good songs. Let's compare, like, Pantera and what they did with, like, Far Beyond Driven and Great Southern Tranquil, those albums. I think Dime and Vinny could actually reign fill in, whereas Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic, they didn't have any say over what direction Kurt wanted to take, and you get In Utero. Or even look at Faith No More, Angel Dust after The Real Thing. Some people really have a problem with Angel Dust. Other things, it's like a masterpiece, but there are some great songs on Angel Dust, but it's just not The Real Thing. I think I really thought about why my views on the album changed from when I was 15 and I first bought this. Because there are plenty of bands and albums that I love just as much now as I did when I was a teenager. But for this particular album, I think it was the, I don't know, youthful inexperience of being a music fan, meaning I was almost willing myself to like this album because I was supposed to, because I enjoyed their other albums. And again, I touched upon this. I think being on a limited income when it came to which cassettes I decided to purchase, I wasn't just going to immediately discard something that cost me a few weeks of savings from like car washes and long cuttings and just get rid of this tape. And today I would just move on, and or our kid today would just move on, go on to the next stream, because there's hundreds of thousands of different bands they can sample without even having to pop down a nickel. So I think this album gets praise simply because it's Nirvana and it was their last official studio album. I think no matter what type of album came out after Nevermind, it was going to sell. If we want to compare to Kiss and
I don't know, Walmart said there was no demand for it.
Well, fuck if I know, with Walmart,
right,
you know.
Me, Sam Walt.
But I think it's kind of like Kiss and the Destroyer album in some ways. For my taste, Destroyer is the most overrated album in the 70s for Kiss, but it came out right after the enormous success of Alive, so it gets all this praise. But Rock and Roll Over and Love Gun, I think, are superior albums, and actually I listen to Dynasty more than Destroyer as well. So I think people really like In Utero because it came after Nevermind, but that's just me. To sum up, I'm a fan of Nirvana. I like you said, I'm not a hater of the band. I like them more than you do. So this isn't, I just don't think this is a great album now that I'm, listened to so much more music, and I apologize to the Nirvana super fans there, but I really think Kurt was in poor shape and it's obvious from the results here. So I push it back. You push it to 24. I pushed it to 22. I just think there are so many other great albums that were behind it, like Purple or Degradation Trip, the single soundtrack, Mad Season, Facelift, obviously. I think Bleach is better. Core versus and Super Unknown. I think those are all far superior. And then the four songs I mentioned, or sorry, four albums that were not in the top 25 are better than In Utero.
Oh, this wouldn't even make my top 25 if I did a personal list.
Sure. Yeah,
actually,
I get that.
Probably none of the Nirvana records would. But that'd be a be a personal list, which is why I went this direction. It really shouldn't be. I didn't want the show to be about me. I wanted it to be about grunge.
Sure.
But, yeah, I actually, you said something there that I don't think I chimed in on that I definitely want to. That is, I think Bleach is a better record, too. And and much like this record, I'd actually heard Bleach more than this album, it turns out. But that one aged better for me than this one did.
Yeah, and I even think I like the compilation of Incesticide better, too.
You know, you're not the first person to say that. I should check that out. But, again, not a fan, so I guess.
No, I mean.
But I'll stumble across that for $2 at a fucking used CD place sometimes.
There you go. There you go. I think it won't change your mind on things, but it's just, for me, it's a better listen.
Right. Well, you know, I like to kind of experience things and kind of, see where I come in, where someone recommends something. So, especially when I hear that kind of thing more than once. But
Yeah.
All right. Well, Brian, last chance to plug anything. Let's talk about the goddamn Magic Music Memories podcast, the soon to be renamed.
Well, it's gone from goddamn movie memories to goddamn magic. We're either playing cards or I'm Houdini or something like that. But
No. Give us a proper plug here.
Sure.
I've been fucking with you the whole time here.
No, I understand. It's Damn Good Movie Memories, and we've been around since 2016. There's over 200 episodes. It started as a kind of a fun thing I used to do at work, where we would just, my coworkers and I would just talk about random things and movies, and became like movie subjects, like, hey, what was the first movie you saw in a theater? And we'd all chime in and have a good time, and it finally just morphed into a podcast. And the first 100 episodes were fun because they were just movie ideas and movie subjects, but then it became kind of like work, and I didn't really want to start, what's your favorite Al Pacino in this particular, I didn't want to do that. So I have such a robust DVD collection. I thought, well, why don't I really enjoy like the bonus features and DVDs, and why don't I make it like the ultimate? If you were to be driving around in your minivan and with your MP3 or your phone, and you wanted to listen to my podcast and you wanted to hear about a movie and kind of visualize the movie like through the audio, like, cause I grew up with old time radio and listening to those really like on cassettes, like Jack Benny and The Shadow and things like that. And so I could paint a picture in my mind I kind of wanted to do that with certain movies. So I would give you the backstory, give you all the, you know, the in-depth, you know, details about a certain film, so that the, you know, somebody that loves the film would gain something new, but then someone that's never seen a movie might give it a chance. And then after they listen to it, they'll go and seek it out. And so I think, that's been the greatest, payoff from all this, is getting messages from folks that are like, hey, I never saw this movie, never even thought about seeing this movie. And thank you for doing that. So I enjoy doing that. That's a lot of fun. And, anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can listen to that. I think for your listeners, they might also be interested in, my radio show that I'm on, thatmetalstation.com, and so it's called The Bad Beat, and so Brian A. Davis, there's your little connection, your acronym, and so it's on every
Wednesday.
What
does the A stand for? Alexander?
Brian, well, Aldini? No, it's, I'll give you a hint, he was a famous action star in the 80s.
Steve?
Starts with an A.
I know that joke was for Chris Inzak.
Okay,
all right, famous action star in the 80s. Albert Schwarzkopf.
Close. Yes. No, it's Arnold. my grandfather's name was Arnold, so that we get bad. And so the bad beat, actually, it is kind of a play on things. If you're a card player, and I'm not, but my dad is, when you go to a casino or a card room and you get a bad beat, it's basically a hand that is supposed to be unbeatable statistically. But there are times where you could get beaten on that hand because whatever happens. And so if you do get a bad beat at a card room, you actually end up winning the hand. They have like this pot because it's kind of like, even if you lose, you still win.
Oh.
So I thought it'd kind of be a fun play on the words with my name and my initials, and so it became The Bad Beat. So on that metal station, so now on thatmetalstation.com, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Pacific, we basically play, you heard about my love of the blues, so it's kind of the evolution of that. And so I'll play like the early masters of the blues, but I'll also play the bands that they're definitely influenced by the blues. And Alice in Chains actually fits in that too. So
and
I do
Rat.
Play Alice in Chains. And I like Rad. I love Rad.
I was just making a blues joke about that.
But they covered Walking the Dog. So there you go.
You do a fabulous job on your show. It is so entertaining to listen to. The way you break everything down, and of course, there's such a, I don't know, just a happy way you kind of flow through it. So yeah, it's a very upbeat, positive show, people. It's not listening to me talk about Nirvana anyway.
But. Well, no, I mean, upbeat. I mean, like, I'll do some dark movies, but the whole thing's supposed to have fun. We're not making money for this. If you're miserable doing your podcast, don't fucking do it. You know, if you're not going to put in the effort, then don't do it. I mean, that's why I do it, for the love of that. And it's for better or worse, it's my legacy. I mean, it's probably what's going to survive more than anything else. It's not my job. I'm not going to, in 20 years from now, I'll talk about the podcast. And most people don't care about what I do for a living. So you might as well have fun with it.
That's interesting. It's quite a legacy I'm leaving then.
I love it. Many others do as well.
Oh, my God. I always enjoy our conversations. Are you coming back to Nashville if they get Rockin' Pod fired up again?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'd like to take a vaccine. That would be nice. So I'd like to do that.
Hopefully we'll have it by then. So
I'm going to avoid the penny royalty, but I want to see everyone in Nashville. I mean, that's how we met. I mean, that's we really we had met at the second one, but we had a better chance to really talk at the third one, and we had really had a blast. And that's the great part about what Chris does, is to organize and get this great community together that I would have never met you if it wasn't for that or podcast world. So, I'm forever grateful to the Rockin' Pod for that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so many relationships, it's weird to have these, like this next wave of friends kind of interrupt your life, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But it's cool.
And,
it's fucking
it's awesome.
But, yeah,
it is absolutely awesome because, unless I was going to visit the Twins ballpark, because I want to see as many ballparks as I can, there's no way I'd probably be in Minnesota to meet you. So there you go.
Well, if that ever happens, make sure to look me up.
Absolutely.
I'll be going to the game with you. But
that'd be terrific.
Well, Brian, as of course you know, I have a bit of a bromance with you. I'm a fan of your podcast. I really enjoy being on your show. You've been kind enough to bring me in and talk about some movies that mean a lot to me, including one coming up here. So thank you so much for offering your insights on the Nirvana record In Utero, and I just really appreciate having you on the show.
Whatever.
All right, never mind.
Blessed life, Baca.
Well, you just be true to who you are.
That's right. And be true to your school, you know?
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.